Hello, welcome to the House of Commons podcast. This is a regular podcast about politics. My name's Mark Thompson. I'm a political commentator and blogger, and I am joined every week by a guest from the world of politics or journalism. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Ian Dunt, who is editor of politics.co.uk. Hello, Ian.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for joining me.
Not at all.
Okay, so there's obviously a few things have happened this week. The first thing that we wanted to talk about is what happened at the offices of Charlie Hebdo, I think it's pronounced, in Paris, where 12 people were killed, and then a number of other people have subsequently been killed, I think it was yesterday, by two Muslim gunmen who were acting, as they saw it, in terms of trying to defend their religion, and because Charlie Hebdo was actually one of the most outspoken publications in terms of publishing cartoons and very, very strong on freedom of speech. And obviously they have paid, and their staff have paid a very, very heavy price for this. I mean, there's a lot of strands to this, Ian, but what are your initial thoughts on what happened and where we are now with this?
Dismay and despair and general sort of morbid horror. So it was, as an attack, it was, I think it's quite clear what the intention was, which was to drive a further wedge between Muslims and Europe and the continent itself and its traditional values and the way that it thinks of itself. And attacks on free speech are a very effective way of doing that, actually. And I think we saw how effective it was compared to, you know, when then it reverts to a more traditional form of appalling terrorism, which is sort of attacking the Jewish community in France. The initial response, I think, from sections of the press was to do exactly as was expected and to start asking questions of the Islamic community that it simply aren't asked of other communities and saying, you know, why is it that this always is Muslims doing it? Of course, that's not true. I mean, the greatest act of European terror that we've had for some time was actually in Norway, was done by a white supremacist who actually would have wanted to maintain our more traditional religions. So none of that stands up, but the response from many people in the media and in the wider community has been exactly as one would have expected, and I think quite depressing.
Yeah, I mean, there's an element of confirmation bias, isn't there, that every time there is some kind of terrorist atrocity that's perpetrated by Muslims, then, you know, people will come out and say, well, it's Muslims again. But when there are terrorist atrocities committed by people who aren't Muslims, I'm not saying they don't get any coverage, obviously they do, but they're not kind of ticked off in that column. And so you do end up with this situation where, you know, I think some people think all terrorist atrocities are now being committed by Muslims, which, as you rightly point out, is just not true at all.
It's funny, isn't it? It's when it's a white person that does something, it's treated as the act of a lone lunatic, basically. Yeah. It's treated as a crime, as a terrible crime, an act of madness. When it's a Muslim who does it, it's part of a sustained campaign against liberal democracy. And it's really framed more in terms of the narrative of a war. I mean, a long protracted terrorist war, but nevertheless, that's the storyline that's told about it.
Yeah. I mean, if we can just slightly look at some of the potential fallout from this act now. I mean, obviously, Charlie Hebdo was one of the most well-known, one of the most prominent publications that was willing to just push free speech and you know, very, very bravely and tragically, as it's turned out. And, you know, quite a lot of other publications have shied away from publishing cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad and, you know, even really covering this sort of thing in too much detail. Do you think that we're now in a situation where some of these publications will more prominently publish cartoons, perhaps in solidarity with what's happened? And maybe there's a kind of enough is enough mentality now. Do you think that's likely to happen, or do you think we'll just be back to the status quo in very short order?
There is this sort of, there's a gap, isn't there, between the way that European publications tend to act, where they seem more comfortable with publishing those images than British publications, which really haven't. The BBC seems to be slowly changing its guidance, but I wouldn't expect much of a significant change from British publications. They may start featuring those images in relation to a report about these stories, but I don't think they will publish them of their own accord. And I'm not sure that there's much value in doing so. Of course, you have the right to do it. And absolutely, you know, the Muslim community needs to understand that it is tolerable and it is legitimate to publish pictures of the Prophet as an act of satire. But whether one would wish to do it is another question entirely. And actually, I would say, I mean, you know, the magazine it's obviously we sort of have as much sadness for the people that died in the magazine. It was such an appalling affront to free speech, and as fellow journalists, it sort of it feels even more upsetting, I think. But I can't say that all of the cartoons that were published in that magazine were proper satire. I mean, some of it was just sort of vapid, hateful mockery, really. So I wouldn't stand up for every single one of those cartoons, even though it goes without saying they have every right to publish them.
Yeah. There was this idea that perhaps every single newspaper in the UK could simultaneously have published the cartoons on the front page of each of their individual papers in an act of solidarity. Now, that hasn't happened. I think it's pretty likely that isn't going to happen. I mean, do you think gestures like that are worthwhile, meaningful, or do you think in the end, maybe not so much and perhaps might just cause more problems?
Well, that's it. And I think that line is very, very difficult. You should be able to, I think you can probably tell by the way that I'm talking that I'm rather torn on these issues myself. Of you don't really want to be forced into this sort of culture war and to accept the binary, you know, this is the thing of accepting the binary opposition that the terrorists wanted you to have, which is the rest of us versus Muslims. And that is not the reality of the situation. So to suddenly, you know, have the pressure, I think, of these publications of putting up images of the Prophet Muhammad. I mean, anything else that the cartoon does, whatever, but specific, you know, even if it's anti-Islamic, but the images of the Prophet Muhammad seemed a very problematic response to have. On the other, you know, we can't just look at this in isolation. This attack is just the worst manifestation of a gradual loss of faith in free speech that we have had in European society, which isn't just from the Muslim community and other, you know, often quite sensitive communities. It often comes from, you know, within the left, from within the right, a tendency that we see in social media to attack the speaker rather than what they are saying and try to close down their right to speak, a tendency to no platform people during panel debates at universities or at conferences. So this is part of a trend that it would do us all well, I think, to redouble our commitment to free speech. Whether that goes as far as, you know, all of us publishing pictures of the Prophet Muhammad, I would be quite wary of that avenue.
Yeah, I mean, you raise an interesting point there because, you know, I mean, you'd probably struggle to find many people in the commentary in the UK who, you know, in response to what's happened with Charlie Hebdo, you know, I imagine most people would argue very, very strongly in favour of free speech, both on the left and the right. But if we just take another example from a few months ago when Hilary Mantel wrote a story about the assassination of Margaret Thatcher, completely fictional, of course. I think it was set in the mid-80s when she was at the height of her powers. And the Daily Telegraph was going to publish it, but then a lot of pressure was put upon them by people from the right. And in the end, they decided not to publish it. It was eventually published. And then people were demanding that Hilary Mantel should apologise and should withdraw the story. And some of those same people who will have been, you know, arguing for free speech in the last few days are the same people who will have been pushing for that to have been withdrawn. And it isn't just people on the right. I mean, you're absolutely. I think sometimes people on the left are the worst at this sort of thing, for demanding that people apologise and resign for, you know, things that they've either said or done. I do think we have quite a strange relationship with free speech in this country.
Yeah, it's true. It's funny, you know, the left has all sorts of very sensitive areas, you know, mostly around gender and race and sexuality. The right has just Margaret Thatcher, really. And occasionally, you know, Kate. If, you know, I mean, Hilary Mantel.
Well, yeah, that was Hilary Mantel again, wasn't it? With and what she wrote about Kate was absolutely fine, as far as, I mean, I'm a Republican, so maybe I would say that, wouldn't I? But she wasn't criticising Kate. She was criticising the entire edifice of the monarchy. And yet it was interpreted through this prism of she's attacking Kate, which was an absolute load of bollocks.
Yeah, it's so true. It's absolutely true. So, I mean, you're right. Both sides have their own various sensitivities. But I think you're correct as well to say that the left is probably a bit worse. And that's come, I think, from this sort of cul-de-sac of identity politics that parts of the left went down when it gave up on making economic arguments. And suddenly, you know, really, it was much more about sexuality and gender and race. And once you get into that territory, the identity of the speaker matters as much as the words that are coming from their mouth. So much of what you see online, for instance, the attack, it's a dreadful word, I'm sorry to have to use it, on mansplaining, you know, and especially from lots of radical feminism and lots of people who subscribe to sort of intersectional critiques, is, you know, you haven't checked your privilege, you know, by virtue of the color of your skin, by virtue of who you are as a man or a woman, you actually don't get to make the statement, or rather your statement is less valid and we shouldn't have to listen to it. And that is just as dangerous and pernicious, really, as the nonsense you get from the right about, you know, wanting to chuck Hilary Mantel in jail because she happened to write a fiction story.
Indeed. And I guess this isn't the problem that's going to be resolved anytime soon. It's just, I guess my fear is that if anything, it's been getting worse in the last maybe 5, 10, 15 years. But anyway.
Oh, I think it definitely has. I mean, we're at one of the lowest points with respect to freedom of speech that I think, I mean, really hasn't been this way since the Troubles when Margaret Thatcher, like once again, did the idiocy of thinking that if you remove the man's voice, then suddenly he will become less effective. So, yeah, it's been a long time since we've gotten to a point this bleak, I think.
And as a small L liberal, I find that quite profoundly depressing. But maybe we should move on to another fairly depressing story, which is that was quite a good segue. I don't usually do segues, but I'm quite proud of that one. The NHS crisis. So we've now got a situation where, although the government reduced the target for people being seen in A&E from 98% of people being seen within 4 hours to 95%. In the last few months, they've been struggling to even hit that, and we've had an average of 92.6% of patients being seen within 4 hours. And actually, in the most recent week to Sunday, it was 86.7 people were seen within 4 hours. So there's obviously something quite seriously wrong here. And of course, I mean, the NHS, even at the best of times, is quite a political football. And obviously, I've seen a lot of commentary and a lot of politicians have been chipping in on this and journalists as well. I mean, what's your take on this, Ian? Do you think that this is a little blip and things will be okay again in a few weeks or a couple of months? Or do you think this is something more systemic and we're actually going to see this kind of thing happen more and more?
No, I think it is systemic, and it comes as a result, really, I think, of cuts to other services. And so this is quite well foreseen. And of course, you know, when Labour spoke about weaponising the NHS, which Cameron quite sort of laughably pretended was the most outrageous, offensive thing he'd ever heard, the reason that they came to that conclusion wasn't just because Labour performs very strongly on the NHS. It's also because the coalition record on the NHS is very bad, and because this was all eminently foreseeable. So if you make substantial cuts to social care, and we have, I mean, you know, we know that that's fallen from 1.8 million to 1.3 million over the course of this parliament, actually slightly smaller windows until 2013. That kind of cut, what that does, of course, is you're having less people going into homes where elderly people are. They're taking less time to wash them, to prepare meals for them, to help them down the stairs. Those small actions that come really from cuts at a local council level do have an effect on the NHS. That is where their effects are felt. And most, when you look at the data, really, it's stuff from Age UK and from Independent Age have for a long time predicted that this would be the result of it. When you have an elderly population in the middle of the winter, you make swinging cuts to social care. This is an entirely unsurprising result.
But
You're convinced of
well,
that.
I know. I think you do have a point there. And I think one of the problems we've had in this country for many, many years is a lack of joined up government. So, you know, different departments are just considered, certainly within Whitehall and within politics in general, as being in separate silos. So your social care is in one part, your NHS stuff is in another part, and then, you know, other perhaps areas that could be considered interrelated are also considered in separate pots. And then you have ministers fighting their corner for their individual departments, and they'll get a budgetary settlement. And there's not a lot of joined up thinking. And the amount of times I've heard politicians say, oh, what we're going to do is we're going to have joined up government. I seem to remember New Labour were quite keen on the rhetoric around that back in the mid to late 90s. But I don't really remember seeing it happen very much. And I think under this government, if anything, it's got worse. However, when it comes to budgets, Labour didn't pledge to ring fence the NHS from the cuts before the 2010 election, whereas the Tories did, and as a result of the coalition agreement, it has been ring fenced. I mean, I think there has been the odd occasion when certain budgets haven't quite been spent and they've been rolled over to the next year, and also there have been the efficiency savings, but that they weren't cuts, they were kind of rolled back into the NHS. So isn't there an argument for saying that this could even have been worse under Labour?
Yeah, it's a funny one, isn't it? Labour's commitment on the NHS really came from the fact that it was at that exact point desperate to look tough because it was suffering in the press against a barrage of, you know, encouragements to commit to cuts, and it needed an area where it looked tougher than the Tories. I don't know how far they would have followed that through on when they were in government if they had won the last election. I think there's been some other stuff that's happened which frankly didn't need to take place in the way that it did. I mean, even, you know, relying on this 111 number instead of NHS Direct, I don't think has done any good. And there's some pretty firm evidence that they're sending more people into A&E than was done under the previous system. And it looks like this GP crisis, which is less talked about but quite real, is also resulting in more people just getting fed up of waiting for a GP appointment and going into A&E. And really, A&E is just that tension point where everything reaches fever pitch. And not necessarily all of that would have taken place under a Labour government. Would it have been so magnificently better? No. I mean, this is a result of spending cuts, and spending cuts would have taken place under a Labour government. Is it possible that there would have been a different approach, for instance, to NHS Direct, for instance, to social care? I think it's possible that there would have been. Yeah.
I mean, I mentioned earlier on that, you know, the NHS is regularly used as a political football. And I mean, and also we talked about the structural problems with the health system in this country, perhaps in general. So maybe if we also include kind of social care in that too. And I think there is a fear that because we're all living longer and, you know, in terms of quality of life, you know, people who are older tend to get ill and then stay ill. And there are treatments that can keep people alive for a very, very long time. But obviously that costs a lot of money. And really, we're slowly moving towards a situation where the amount of money that we're going to need to keep putting into the NHS and into social care is going to increase so much year on year that in, let's say, you know, 20, 30 years' time, we're going to just reach a point where it's taking so much of the proportion of our GDP that it is actually unsustainable. And perhaps what we're seeing here with the A&E crisis is just a little kind of future shock of what we'll be facing eventually. I mean, do you think that there's some truth in that? And what's the answer? Because every time politicians of any party really try and make any significant changes to the NHS. So, I mean, we saw this with Tony Blair's reforms. You know, people on the hard left were absolutely disgusted with what Blair was doing and, you know, were very, very opposed to it. And if Labour hadn't had such a big majority, it never would have happened. And as soon as the Tories get in and try and make any changes, Labour scream and scream and scream at them that they're privatising the NHS, even when, you know, quite a lot of what this government has done was just continuing what Labour had done in office. So, you know, any kind of structural reforms are very, very politically difficult. And at the moment, when we're in the run-up to a general election, you would hope and expect that this is the time when these issues would be debated. But actually, that's not really happening. The whole issue is so politically charged that the debate just kind of gets shut down and gets polarised with people just shouting slogans at each other.
I think you only find market reform of the NHS under Labour in the same way that you will only find a Home Secretary willing to take on the police under the Tories.
Yeah, it's like the whole only Nixon can go to China syndrome, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. You can only play in the opposition's play pit. And I think that will be an abiding law forever. I mean, that's just how it goes. One of the most insane things the coalition did, I'm afraid, is actually following through with that Lansley reforms to the NHS, not least because it was just so, it had such little democratic legitimacy. I mean, you can't go into an election promising one thing and then do the exact opposite. But also because they were so fundamentally misunderstood at almost every single level, you know, from Clegg, all the way down to the hospital level, no one really understood what Lansley was trying to do. And it wasn't particularly accomplished what he was trying to do. And the results have not been good. And actually, it does seem like it's cost an extraordinary amount of morale at a GP level and at a deeper level in the NHS. If Labour get back in and then spend the next 10 years reversing it, that is, you know, that will basically be a decade of utterly pointless managerial tinkering from Whitehall. And again, we start to ask those questions, which isn't about marketisation and it's not about provision by the state, but is really about how do we make it so that we can stop people coming in at a Whitehall level and implementing reforms that they barely understand and don't have to see the consequences of? How do we devolve the power down for the management of those hospitals to as local level as possible so that we get rid of Whitehall's influence altogether?
Yeah, I mean, I almost wonder if we need another, like a modern beverage report that kind of does a full drains up analysis of the entire system and then comes up with some proposals that, you know, if it was done in an unpartisan way, perhaps, you know, all the major parties could get behind and, you know, push for reform. Because at the moment, you know, any party that's in government that's going to try and push reform is going to be opposed by all sorts of vested interests and other politicians and the media. And it's just, you know, it's like, I can't remember who the quote is from, but you know, the NHS is the closest thing we have to a national religion. And it does seem like that it's very, very, very difficult. Probably, it's probably one of the most difficult things in politics to do to make changes to the NHS. You know, Lansley obviously found out to his cost. I agree with you actually that the way that this government went about those changes, they'd have been far better off not doing the changes at all. And you know, maybe just kind of, you know, peddling slowly on it for a few years and just give things a chance, because there have been so many changes in the last 20 years that a period of no change would be quite a good thing. But this comes back to the thing I've said many, many times, which is politicians don't get elected on a platform of no change. You know, if you you know, if you're campaigning, and this goes right down to the grassroots level. I mean, I've stood in a couple of council by-elections, and you know what you can't do is knock on doors and say, "Vote for me, we'll leave things exactly as they are." You can't do that because you won't get elected. So, you know, politicians always feel the need to change things, and you know, I think in some cases that's maybe not a good thing.
Well, honestly, to be fair, that is how they ran on a no top-down reorganisation of the
Well,
NHS.
yeah,
I
you're
think
right,
that
actually. That was a slight exception to the rule, wasn't it? Precisely because the Tories aren't trusted on the NHS. That's why they said that.
exactly, and that's why it was so baffling to see them just sign off on these reforms. Which I don't even think Cameron understood them. I mean, Clegg certainly didn't, but I don't think Cameron did either. And so suddenly you just think, why have you done this thing? And really, Lansley just seemed to want to catch up with the more radical proposals being done by his ministerial colleagues. I would warn, actually, that, you know, where you go with reform, especially about private involvement, my difficulty with private involvement is this, is that they tend to cherry-pick the most profitable, easy operations and sectors, and take those and leave the most expensive stuff to the taxpayer. So, you know, knee operations, which are, you know, very, very simple, get quickly snapped up and taken on. Then, of course, when there's something wrong with your knee that no one really knows what the matter with it is, you lose that holistic care because suddenly you don't become cost effective. It's quite difficult to make a quick profit off you. And you just get lost in this system, which doesn't talk to itself very well because it's run by small independent providers. So that always, the efficiency claims of private involvement always make me rather concerned. I rather prefer just to push down the decision-making power to a local level. If people want to bring in private involvement there, then that's their own concern. But I think that sort of preemptive way of where the decisions are made rather than what the decisions are is probably a smarter way of looking at NHS reform than the way we currently do it.
I think probably ultimately you are right, and we're going to have to move on from this topic because we're going to run out of time otherwise. I will just say two words: postcode lottery. But
Yeah, fair enough.
that is a debate for another day, I think.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
All right. Okay. The third thing we're going to talk about, I think this was something that you yourself nominated in, you wanted to talk about, which is related to a piece that you wrote on politics.co.uk about, I mean, the way I've summarised it in my notes here is Cameron following Merkel. Do you want to just elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, I just thought, I mean, it kind of got lost because of the events in Paris, but Angela Merkel's trip to the UK was very, very interesting, and we saw a significant amount of watering down of Cameron's proposals during his November immigration speech. As he sat during the press conference, he says, "Look, I've always been very clear about what I was trying to achieve." Whenever Cameron says very clear, usually he's about to do something a little bit dodgy. And this time he listed these four proposals that he had for immigration and welfare. And there was a rather significant absence there. And that was his claim before that European citizens would need to have a job offer before they could come to the UK. Now that, when you talk to immigration lawyers after that keynote November speech, was always the bit that they were saying, look, he's not going to get that bit passed. It's interesting that it comes, you know, the Daily Mail's report before Merkel arrived said that she, 48 hours before that speech, had forced him to U-turn on the idea of a cap on European citizens coming here or an emergency break. If you remember, for a couple of months before that much hyped speech, those ideas were trailed quite heavily in the press. They were nowhere to be found when the speech took place. So she obviously stopped him there. It also looks that before the press conference, she stopped him on this idea of European citizens having a job offer before they arrive in the UK. And actually, you know, bafflingly enough, even though he's clearly U-turning all over the place with as much sort of respectability as he can muster, this is quite good for Cameron, because what it suggests is that she can work with him on the other bits, which is really the things that Germany shares his concern about, which is, you know, traveling for benefits or something that I'm not entirely sure completely exists. But there, she probably will work with him and get the rest through. But all that radical, sort of more robust anti-immigration stuff in that speech pretty much gone the way of the dodo, and no one's really noticed.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So you are basically saying that you think that Cameron might have a shot at getting some reasonable reforms to the EU, perhaps enough reforms that the bulk of political opinion gets behind the idea that he has managed to change things enough that it's worth having a referendum on, even if some of his, you know, wingnut, you know, right wingers don't agree, and frankly they never would. But if you can keep those to a small enough sliver, then you think if the Tories are in government after the election, that they might actually be able to pursue a renegotiation and then a referendum. Because I've been thinking for a long time that that just won't work. He will never be able to get enough from Europe in order to make it a plausible scenario that we should have a referendum on a renegotiated settlement. And instead, he'll be forced into a position where he'll have to advocate out.
Yeah, and I think he is going to manage it. And, you know, is it going to be enough to convince everyone? It's another question. I'm pretty convinced he'll get most of the press on side. And I think he'll manage to get most of his party probably on side, as long as he just has some pretty tough stuff on benefits. What he's not going to be able to do is challenge freedom of movement in any way. And that's where Angela Merkel has blocked him off one point after another point after another point. It has to be said, it's in our benefits for her to have done so. And it's a rather despairing situation that we find ourselves in, that we need a German chancellor to come save the British economy from a British prime minister. What? But of course, European citizens bring in so much more than they take away from the state. Our deficit would be so much worse than it would be without them here. So in actual fact, she's really saving us from ourselves.
I mean, I also wonder if maybe Cameron's slightly been caught in a pincer movement here with Merkel on one side and Osborne on the other, because it's pretty well known that Osborne hasn't been happy about quite a lot of the proposals for restricting freedom of movement, because, you know, from his vantage point in the Treasury, he knows full well that, you know, how good for our economy that freedom of movement is. So I'm not sure if he was prime minister, he'd have taken a different tack to Cameron anyway. So maybe it's not just external influences, maybe it's also a little bit internal influences too.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? There's always been that split in the Tory party, that sort of Shire's Tory, the small business owner, and it's really quite split from the metropolitan big business laissez-faire free market attitude of people like George Osborne. And George Osborne, as it said, doesn't really like all this anti-immigrant talk. I mean, beyond the economics of it, he just finds it all a little bit distasteful, and it's not really where he comes from. He's a much more cosmopolitan figure than that. Nevertheless, he's struggled to win that fight within the Tory party for rather obvious reasons, I think. Which is that it's become unruly to the point of anarchy, and is only showing any discipline right now because it's so short a period of time until the general election. As soon as that vote is over, it will go back to its default setting, which is, you know, just lunacy, really. Yeah. But I think Cameron's done about as much as he possibly can while keeping Merkel on side, and it's ultimately Merkel who's the big wild card in this. She can slap him down whenever she wants, and it appears that she has done just about enough to help the British economy get through the lunacy of the Tory party.
Okay, well, we'll park that one there for now. I'm sure we'll come back to this story again and again. And just before we finish, just briefly, so David Cameron appears to have thrown up some chaff, as far as I'm concerned, regarding the leaders' debates, and he's demanded that the Greens be included, otherwise he's going to take his ball and walk away. But in the last 24 hours, a consortium of various online and media organisations has agreed to have a five-way debate, which would include the Greens, basically calling Cameron's bluff. Obviously, this is still an evolving story, but as far as I'm concerned, it's looked to me for a long time like Cameron's trying to do anything he can to wriggle out of these debates. Do you think he's actually snookered now and he's going to have to do them?
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? I mean, he's going to struggle in the end to manage to escape any debate whatsoever. And it would be wonderful if this was the breakout moment, that suddenly it was digital media that was providing this instead of the broadcasters. Because after all, it was fundamentally the broadcasters who dropped the ball. It was wrong of them to be so paternalistic as to assume that they had any right to say the Greens shouldn't be on there. And they were, you know, also, as it happened, handed David Cameron his opportunity to get out of the things in the first place. So I do rather hope that he is snooking and it was online outlets that did it.
And if he still refuses and somehow tries to wriggle out, do you think he should just be empty chaired by both the online consortium and also all the broadcasters and just have the debates anyway?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I mean, this is not just a one-off thing with Cameron. I mean, he can't stand scrutiny. This isn't brought up against him very often. But remember, he cancelled the monthly Downing Street press conferences. When Gordon Brown, for all his faults, used to do that, he did not leave that room until everyone that had their hand up had asked a question. You know, he'd been there for an hour. There was a woman from Japanese TV with very bad English, you know, struggling to ask her question. He made sure everyone in that room got a question. David Cameron, of course, basically scrapped those. When he does a press conference, he speaks to about three people, which is really, you know, the BBC, Sky, and maybe one newspaper, you know, let alone the idea that websites could get a look in. I mean, the newspapers barely get a look in. And, you know, even during general election time, he refuses most interviews. So this is not just these TV debates. As a prime minister, he really can't stand scrutiny. He's not very good at putting himself open to questions.
Actually, that's just reminded me of something that was very, very funny that I saw over the Christmas break. Charlie Brooker did his 2014, you know, Screenwrite Review of the Year. And he put together this montage of all the times that Cameron's been being interviewed by someone. And he gives his initial answer and then he just walks away. And it happens again and again and again. Honestly, there's about 10 examples of it. And the more I was watching, I was thinking, yeah, I've seen him do that as well. Where he gives his speech and he literally turns around and just walks off before the interviews even had a chance to respond to his question. That's quite remarkable. I can't really remember any other politicians doing that, at least in, you know, that level of frequency.
And it is, you know, it's that complaint that you always used to hear from Tory backbenchers, which is, oh, he's so arrogant, he's so superior, he's so aloof. You know, you look at those things and that, I'm afraid, you know, that is what he is. I mean, you know, he does sort of consider himself rather too high up to have to answer these questions. And when you look at on the stump, those TV interviews, that sense of arrogance is much harder for him to hide than, for instance, when he does BBC Breakfast and it's all very jovial on a sofa somewhere.
Yeah, unless he's on the one show with Matt Baker, but that was a slightly different thing. Okay, well, thanks very much for your time, Ian. It's been great to chat to you, and love to have you back on again at some point before the election if you're up for it.
Absolutely.
Great. I'll look forward to that. And it just remains for me to thank Audio Boom, who very kindly hosts the podcast for us on the internet. And I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music. And we'll be skipping a week next week, so I'll be back in 2 weeks' time.